me? Can you hear me? I'll start singing if y'all don't talk to me. Start singing. You'll be very unhappy. You'll be very unhappy with me. I'm Rob Olson. I want to welcome everyone to another, I guess I always call it semester, spring semester kickoff of the Dallas Wasser Swarm. And how long have we been around, Jack? 30 years? Close to 30 years, we've been providing philosophy to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and we're really glad you all are here. And I especially appreciate coming out on a night like tonight with the cold and the rain. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. Anyone your first time visitors? Okay, several of you? Awesome, yeah. Dr. Pawlowski has a big following here, and we're really glad to see everybody. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Our treasurer, Jack Youngkin, the cost is $5. It's much better than, much less expensive than the Cowboys game. Yeah. And if you're a student, you can attend for $2. And I want to just talk briefly about our schedule for, hopefully everyone has a copy of this. If not, then I can bring one around, because we've got, we're really excited about our schedule this coming year for the spring. We've got Jerry Biddens. Jerry's here. He's going to be speaking on science, technology, and philosophy. We're going to be speaking on economics. Any economists here? No economists? We have a couple of programs on economics. We've got a session on anarchism. Any anarchists in the room? Okay, we've got a few anarchists. We've got a session on criminal law and medicine. Any criminals?
Sure.
We have two Texas poet laureates coming in a few weeks. Any poets? No. A few poets out there. We've got a session on big history. One of David Alkeck, one of his colleagues, is going to be speaking on big history. Kant's moral imperative. Capitalism. We're going to have a great lineup, and we encourage everyone to come out for the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month. And I also want to remind you to pay for your meals if you haven't already, and make sure you are generous with your wait staff. We appreciate that very much. Also, if you want to pay for 6 months, then the cost is $35, and so that's a good, great bargain. Is even a better bargain on that. I also want to recognize Ken Sauter, who handles all of our sound. He handles our website. He does a lot of work. He's the very first one here, so I want to recognize him for coming out here. He makes all this work and all the technology and all that, so I want to recognize him. We also have, wanted to mention, there is going to be a Metroplex Breakfast Dialogue, Neuroscience, Health, and Longevity. That's this coming January 11th. If you're interested in this session on neuroscience, health, and longevity, talk to Jerry afterwards, and he can give you the details on that, okay? And also, all this information is available on philosophersforum.com, .org. Ken's all involved in that. And then I want to mention Tuesday, January 22nd, Jerry Biddens, I said, he's going to have another person, a sort of scientist. Jerry's on, it's a psychologist, and he'll have John Wiley, who's a physicist, and they'll be speaking on science, technology, and philosophy. So, but before I introduce my speaker, we're planning on about a 45-minute talk, and then we're going to open up for questions. We're having some problems with our mic, and so we may ask you to speak up more loudly than usual and to get your questions out. And we encourage you to make just one or two or three brief statements and then get on with your question. Last thing, please turn off your cell phones. We'll put them on vibrate mode at this time. We are very honored to have a retired physician. Well, you're never retired. Once an MD, always an MD, right? Dr. Paul Pawlowski, who was an internist for nearly 35 years. He has just finished writing a book entitled The Dance of Stardust, a Seeker's Guide to Miracles. And he's going to be speaking about the everyday life, the miracles that are found in everyday life this evening. We're very fortunate to have him here, and we're speaking on the topic. The title of this topic is The Miraculous Nature of Human Nature. So now please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Tavolosky.
Speak to this august group, and I thank everybody for helping celebrate Elvis's 78th birthday at the Philosopher's Forum. Special thanks to some of my old friends from prior decades of my life, prior epics in my life, though some of them have said they're going to be heckling and booing throughout my talk. I want to ask before I start, since I've talked about the miraculous nature of human nature, is there anybody to start with who, when you think about your own human nature, thinks of it being miraculous? Got one vote, two, three, four. Not bad. So I'll see if I can persuade the rest. My own sort of quest or falling into the world of miracles. Some people in here were my patients, and so they will tell you I was not a moon child. I'm a traditional doctor. But in my 20s, I wanted a miracle in my life, and I thought it wasn't fair. One of my best friends in my life here is a Methodist minister. I thought it's not fair that only religious people get to believe in miracles. I would categorize myself as spiritual but not religious, and it occurred to me that the only miracles people are about to believe in are religious ones. So I wanted to experience something that it didn't matter if you were religious or not, it counted as a miracle, that everyone would recognize it as such. And I thought, while I'm wishing, why don't I pick one? So I thought my favorite, if I get to pick one miracle, not really believing such a thing could happen, I was attracted to the burning bush story in the Bible. And let me say, I don't believe that it's a true story, but I thought it would be awfully handy to have one of those burning bushes. I'm sure you know the story, whether you believe it or not. Moses is supposed to free the slaves in Egypt, but instead he punches out one of the Egyptian guards. He's exiled out into the wilderness. It looks like he's going to live his life in oblivion. And he, in the middle of nowhere, he comes upon a bush that's burning but not consumed by the fire. And from this bush, he gets divine guidance as to what to do with his life. Moses, go back to Egypt, free the slaves. And I thought, well, my life's as confused as anyone else's. I could use one of those burning bushes. I would like, for consultations, I would like to have a bush that burns and is not consumed by the fire, through which I find out what I'm supposed to do with my life. Well, I didn't for a moment think it would actually happen. And years went by, I didn't experience any miracles, not that one, not any miracle, and I felt like the problem was on the supply side. I didn't see any miracles because there weren't any. One day, a doctor invites me to lunch, and I get to his office at noon, and I have a seat in the waiting room. His nurse tells me he'll be out in a couple minutes. He's finishing his last patient. So I sit, and there's a table there, one magazine. I pick up the one magazine in my boredom. I open it randomly, and I find that I'm, Bennett knows this story, I find that I'm reading about the French scientist Lavoisier. I practice the pronunciation. I never say it the same way twice. L-A-V-O-I-S-I-E-R. Lavoisier, the article said, he lived in the 1700s. He was guillotined during the French Revolution. And the article says he was credited with being the first to figure out that breathing, which we do, and with the oxygen out with the carbon dioxide, he figured out that this was a result of combustion, burning, that basically every animal is burning, including me. It took me several days from the time I read the article to the time I realized that I'm burning and not consumed by the fire. And that is to say that I was the very miracle that I was seeking. And then it dawned on me, well, if I am, that means all of you are. Does that lessen my sense of the miraculous? I mean, here I got the exact miracle I wanted, but everybody else is as miraculous as me. So what I consider miraculous, I'm thinking, is commonplace. Does that lessen its miraculous nature? Well, you'll have to think about that through the rest of the talk, your own opinion about that, because I'm going to tell you more about yourself. But one thing I recognized was that this miracle that I thought was impossible was actually so commonplace that its miraculous nature was hidden. Every animal is burning without being consumed. Each of you is a fire, just like me. For the scientists in the group, those of you who are eating tonight, you think you were driven by hunger to order the enchiladas, but that ain't so. Hunger was a prompt to tell you you need more fuel to keep the fire burning. That is the fire through which you burn but are not consumed. And what's actually happening with those enchiladas is you're extracting the protein from them to maintain your infrastructure, and any extra protein plus the fats and carbohydrates, you burn. So every day of your life, that's what you're doing. When you're getting hungry, you are gathering fuel. So what I want to do, in general, then I recognize what I want to look at is ordinary life and think about it, what's really going on. So first I want to place you in a semi-cosmic context. So first I'll ask you to think about how old you are, and you're thinking, that's really a simple question, too straightforward for the philosopher's forum. There's got to be a catch. So I'll make it a little trickier. You were made from pre-existing raw materials. How old are the raw materials from which you're made? Time's up. We don't have all night. The raw materials that you were made from are as old as the universe. There are many theories about how the universe started. There are religious ones which differ from each other depending upon the religion. There are scientific ones. We can talk about them if you want during the questions at the end. But let's say no one knows for sure how the universe started. Some of you may have strong feelings about it. But a one or two sentence history of the universe starting then would be something like this. that original stuff has been changing ever since it came into being, and everything that's ever existed is a transformation of that original stuff. So I'm telling you, every galaxy, every star, whether it's still existing or no longer existing, is a transformation of the original stuff. Every dinosaur, trilobite, or extinct organism, everything that's existing now is a transformation of that original stuff. So it's estimated that the universe is about 13.7 billion years old. So I'm telling you that despite your chronological age, you're made raw materials that are estimated to be 13.7 billion years old. Or if you want to twist around the way you think of it, it took the universe 13.7 billion years to make you, her.
Job well done.
So I'm not saying that that was the intent of the universe, but each of us is the end. Each of us is the product of 13.7 billion years of the universe transforming. You're made of atoms. Each of you is made of atoms. How old are they, and where did they come from? Again, time's up. That's a tough two-part question. Your atoms are older than you. I'll divide them into two groups, the hydrogen and everything else. The hydrogen, if the universe is 13.7 billion years old, the hydrogen's thought to be over 13 billion years old. Well, the significance of that is you're about 60% water, H2O. So that is lots of hydrogens. Over half of your body's atoms are hydrogen. So over half of them are thought to be over 13 billion years old, the atoms that are within you tonight in El Phoenix. Now, the other atoms that are within you, the other 40 or so percent, have a pretty exotic history. Also, they're thought to be the product of stars. Universe was thought to be filled with a gas cloud that was about 3/4 hydrogen and 1/4 helium, and you can't make much just with that. But the hot spots of the universe, the high energy spots, are the stars. And particularly, as they get to the end of their existence as stars, they explode. If they're big enough, they explode, and their energy increases enormously then. So all the other elements, all the other atoms within you, are almost all of them are thought to have been produced by stars. So think about that. Think of the Milky Way galaxy. Here's a star exploding and putting out oxygen and carbon and nitrogen, and here's another one. And so the atoms that are now you in this restaurant have been gathered from around the galaxy and en route to you. Along the way, so picture the gas clouds of space being enriched each time one of these stars explodes. Then picture Earth condensing out of this gas cloud. Earth is estimated to be about 4.6 billion years old. So if the universe is 13.7 billion years old and Earth is 4.6 billion, you can see that about two-thirds of the history of the universe happened before there was a sun or a solar system. We were latecomers. We needed all these atoms. For us to be here, we needed to condense out of a gas cloud that was enriched by these other atoms. So when you are breathing oxygen, which you're doing to sustain this fire within you, it was a product of a star now extinct, multiple stars now extinct that exploded and enriched space with the oxygen. What I've told you is that your body is quite ancient in terms of its materials, that the atoms had been gathered from around the galaxy. And the trick is just getting started. So again, think about, is it miraculous anywhere along the way? Would you use the word miraculous for any of these stages? Because the next stage is, even though this is just what happened, it's science, I'm not saying it's, but Earth condenses out of these gas clouds, so you've got all these atoms gathered from around the universe, and now Earth has mechanisms to bring them to life. Earth bunches atoms together that have never been alive before, that have been collected from around the universe, and turns some of those atoms into squirrels, and some into whales, and some into dandelions, and has turned some of them into philosophers. Central to that process is DNA. DNA is present in every living cell of every form of life currently found on Earth. So it does lots of things, but the first thing it does then is it lines up some of those atoms into geraniums. DNA lines, there are millions of species. No one knows how many species there are. But each of them is a different way that the atoms of Earth have been brought to life. And the theists will say that this is the way God did it. And the atheists will say, still pretty cool that Earth, however it happened, that their DNA has organized atoms into all these species. Everything you see, it's got DNA in every cell. So it not only brought every species into existence, it's through DNA, but every one of those species can reproduce. Not an easy trick. Some of the mechanisms are quite bizarre and exotic, but every species can reproduce. But since this talk is mostly about you, let's think about what DNA has done with you. So 9 months before you were born, I don't want to tell you exactly what your parents did, but you can speculate that they had sex. That's true. It's time to face it. Dad's sperm carried half the DNA that's to become you. It penetrated mom's egg that had the other half of the DNA that would become you. There's now a fertilized egg, one cell, and that was you. But that cell had your DNA in it. And now you're trillions of cells, and they all have the same DNA, the exact same DNA as that first cell. Well, think what that DNA had to do. Let me have a stiff drink to see the suspense. In human DNA, there's about 20,000 genes. And different combinations of those genes are activated in different parts of your body. So, for example, in your face, a certain combination of the genes would be activated that would create light-sensitive cells that would allow you to have eyes. In your chest, different combination of those 20,000 genes are activated that allows you to have oxygen-extracting lungs. Well, what good does that do you? Remember that oxygen you're extracting has made its way from exploding stars to support your metabolism, your fire that doesn't go out. So you need a distribution network, and darn it if you don't have other cells within your chest whose combination of genes that are turned on turn it into a heart that pumps 100,000 times a day and delivers this oxygenated blood through all the cells of your body. Now, anyone want to guess the mileage on the circulation you got? If you were to stretch your blood vessels end to end, how far would it go? Times up again, it's about 30 to 50,000 miles is the estimate of how long the blood vessels would go. And you say, I'm not big enough for that. You're making that stuff up. Well, no one's measured them, but you have trillions of cells. Each of them needs circulation, and all your cells are within two or three cells of the nearest capillary. So if you think of it that way, you've got to supply trillions of cells, and most of that mileage is in capillaries, which are so narrow that blood cells just squeeze through one cell at a time. So here you are, where some sets of genes have been activated to extract oxygen, some sets of genes have been activated to deliver that oxygen to your tissues. We've talked some about the digestive process. What you've done every meal your whole life is that you're turning something else into you. You're turning whatever you ate. You were one cell, and everything since then is something that wasn't you that has become you. And so you spend each day collecting new stuff to be you. A good example, I think, is if you have a campfire, you think of it as the same campfire at 10 o'clock that it was at 7 o'clock, but obviously, you know, it isn't the same wood in the campfire. You've had to keep throwing new logs on, so that campfire has a different makeup at each point in time, and you are the same. You're not a closed system. You're constantly turning new stuff into you. You're constantly exchanging atoms with the outside world, so you are a process always becoming. You're always becoming. You aren't a fixed thing. You have kidneys to clear out toxic substances. I mean, all these different parts of your body, you're thought to have 200 some odd different types of cells, all of which have the same DNA, but all of which are organized into different organ systems that support each other and keep each other alive. And I cheated slightly when I told you that this is the story of you, because it's actually the story of all life. Every form of life on Earth is made from atoms that started in space. They were lifeless as they were collected by Earth, were brought to life by Earth, and DNA turned them into specialized tissues that worked together and reproduced. What makes us unique is that we can, our minds presumably make us unique. We're not fast moving. We don't have that many athletic skills. It's our minds. Rob said we could charge an extra $5 for if I perform a miracle. So I'm going to do that right now. Herb, happy Elvis's birthday to you.
Thank you so much, and to you as well.
So Herb thanked me. So let's see how ordinary that was. It's the most casual thing. Everything I've said is the most casual thing. Everything I've told you about yourself is quite casual. So what just happened was, if my head were in a functional MRI machine, just prior to me being aware that I was going to wish a happy Elvis's birthday to her, my brain would start lighting up in a pattern where it's trying to form a coalition, and no one knows how consciousness works, but somehow that coalition formed that moves me over the edge into a thought. So all these atoms that make up my brain after their long journey through space are organized in such a way that I was able to generate a thought, a non-physical, intangible thought. So that's part of the trick. So then the next trick that I had to perform was I have language centers that have to encode that thought. And so I don't know how I do it, and I'm doing it on purpose, but I'm vibrating my vocal cords and say 100 times a second, I'm vibrating my vocal cords. So I'm setting up air pressure waves in my mouth and my throat. That's part of the trick. So there's high and low pressure waves that I've generated. Before I exhale out those words, I shake the wave with my lips, with my teeth, my tongue, my jaw. I don't know how I do it, but we do it so easily that we don't realize that I've not only generated this thought and encoded it, but now I'm shaping a wave which sends at 100 vibrations a second, organizing the air between me and you, between me and her, so that this has a waveform that vibrates your eardrum 100 times a second, activates different features within your ear, and then your brain gets a message, incoming vibrate, not only incoming vibrations at 100 cycles per second, but you can decode these pressure waves that I've sent to you. So Herb decoded it, and he answered me. He did the same thing. So what he encoded a response. So what I'm telling you is, think about any part of your body. Think about what it does. Think about what your eyes do, what your ears do. Think about a conversation. Think about that somehow you're programmed to have legs. Reproduction's pretty wild to think about. I think that the ordinary life that we have, to me, is beyond conception. I'm a doctor, and I would see a retired doctor, but still, I was constantly stunned at the way the body works, that all these parts hold together and support each other. And think of what your mind can do. I won't belabor the point further, but I hope that you recognize that you are a fire. You're my miracle. You're the fire that burns without being consumed. Every communication, you should be amazed that you're able to do it. And I hope that you recognize the miraculousness within yourself. And look at the world. All this stuff is cosmic atoms. All these bushes are cosmic atoms that have been gathered to Earth. So I think maybe I'll stop the formal part of my speech now, in hopes that you think about yourself and think about how from atoms, hydrogen atoms that are 13 billion years old, and atoms from a bunch of stars that we could sit here in El Phoenix and have this talk. So happy Elvis's birthday to everybody, and open for questions.
Speak up.
happy Elvis' birthday to you again, Paul. In reading your book and talking to you about it, and we talked about the fact that every day when you wake up, you should wake up with a smile, because this is just, you know, glorious being alive and being able to think, to talk, to interact with people. And how can you envision transferring this to, I mean, you've transferred it to the whole room, but they may leave here still being the same person that may get depressed for periods of time and whatever, but how can you envision the, your ideas can really change the world and change people and maybe provide world peace for us?
Well, I think Herb was saying what happens when you leave the room. And he's right. I mean, life has a mixture of experiences. Certainly, if you judge human nature by what you read in the media, it's been gathered specifically for showing the darkest side of human nature. Certainly, bad things are part of every life. Tragedy is part of every life. I thought it was interesting that our dog threw up on our living room carpet just as we were leaving to come to the talk. So I absolutely am not always conscious of the miracle of life. But that doesn't mean it's not there. I mean, we all have bad experiences that are real. But that doesn't take, I think we're much more aware of what's wrong with our life. We tend to compare our life with perfection, with an ideal, I think. And so we're aware of how our life deviates from the ideal, and we tend to focus much more on what's wrong with it. You know, my knees hurt, my back hurts. All this is true. But we don't compare ourselves to say what it's like to live in a refugee camp in a war-torn area. That's not our standard of comparison. So I think we have a negative bias in the way we think about our own life. I was guilty of that, and what I'm saying is, we are miraculous despite the events, the mixed events of a life. In a conversation where we skim the surface, we hear the words in the conversation, we don't think of the miraculous process. That how many times does it cross the border of the miraculous that we can communicate? So my answer to your question is, the Zen masters say you can't hold it all the time. You can't stay in a state of bliss all the time. You just have to know it's accessible, and that if you recognize that it exists, you can go back to it, to that way of thinking from time to time. So I would say, where you know it's accessible, and you're good at finding ways to get there. We all have to find our ways to get there. Who's the handsome man?
Speak up, please.
Along those same lines, Pat, do you envision a course or a workbook as a companion to this masterpiece that you created?
We'll see about that. Thank you. Thank you for the plug. I finished writing this book about a year ago and spent last year realizing how impossible it is for an unknown person to get published. I know there's other authors in the group that have experienced that. For me, the key is setting time aside every day to not get swept up in the course of superficial events and to think about the reality that I'm able to think about. And I can look at anything. I use the dog as a cover, and I'll go walking through the neighborhood, and I'll see a tree, and I'll think, how does that work? I mean, that tree is capturing sunlight from 93 million miles away. It's got roots in the ground. It is able to extract from the earth everything a tree needs to live. It can drop acorns or whatever to have the next generation of trees. So it doesn't take much for me now, because I do practice looking for miracles. I look at the ordinary world. That's where they are. So I don't, by looking around at ordinary things and thinking what's under the surface, that would be my one-step approach. But
I have a question right over here.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm checking the definition for a miracle, an event that appears inexplicable by the laws of nature and so is held to be supernatural in origin or an act of God. Is that your definition? Do you have another?
Well,
and how to buy your book and the name of this book?
Well, it's not out yet, I will self-publish it. On the first page of the book, I said that is the definition. The thing about defying the laws of science is you can't do it because science comes along after the fact, and whatever exists, science says this is the way it is. So science would say, if every house had a burning bush, science would say some bushes burn and get consumed by fire, and other bushes, called burning bushes, just burn and don't get consumed. So my definition is that you can't ever defy the laws of science, because science will just change with any new kind of insight. Well, that's there was a reason for it. So I don't include that in my definition.
First, a comment. You give new meaning to the word Adam's family.
Adam.
Yeah, the Adam family. I love your analogy of Moses, because you're right. I'm a seminary graduate. A lot of people are looking for extraordinary in order to keep moving. And what you're saying is actually extremely ordinary, but it is extraordinary as well. Have you thought about taking that into the school system? Because in the school system, it's always, don't do drugs, don't kill people. But if you came in and said, you're a miracle, I think that would have a profound effect on the young people.
Well, I've got a book that I'm going to self-publish, and if anyone has any suggestions as to where I could share my ideas, I would be delighted to do. I just think what it is, that whatever you had to eat or drink is now you. It is.
Once you get it published, Kim, we can get it on our website.
Oh, yeah.
We can have it linked on our website. Young lady right here.
I was going to say, in addition to any religious training that a family wishes to impart to their children at a very, very early age, I would think that this kind of education would have to be just fundamentally moving, I mean, completely extraordinary to a youngster.
Well, I
they
think
were taught that at an early age, in addition to anything else that their parents wanted them to know.
Well, thank you. I think that we just have a blind spot for ordinary life, that anything that happens all the time just seems ordinary to us, and nothing is ordinary. Nothing about us is ordinary. Think about any part of yourself. As I speak, I told you that not only am I shaping these waves, but there's high and low pressure waves. The difference between the high and the low pressure in the waves of my speech is about one part in 10,000. So on that one part in 10,000, your eardrums vibrate, and you can decode these waves, these pressure waves that I've generated somehow by my lips or whatever it is. So I find ordinary life is, what I thought would be a miracle if it really existed in Egypt thousands of years ago turned out to be the most ordinary of things. And I still, again, as I see people eating, it's stunning that we're building ourselves. We're turning this into us. Our digestive system, you take the enchiladas, and as I say, you extract the protein, your GI tract breaks it down to its basic ingredients, so it sends through the blood vessels the breakdown products of this meal. Your heart takes that stuff and turns it into heart. And your liver takes that stuff and turns it into liver. Your brain takes the same stuff and turns it into brain. What is ordinary about us? And again, we have to live out lives of challenge. It isn't easy. Somebody's got to clean up our carpet, among other things. David, were you...
back to miracles. David Hume, I think, said, there to be a miracle, then God has to act outside of his own laws of nature that he set up to act outside of, something that's against his own laws of nature. That's what a miracle is. I think what you're talking about is miraculous. So exquisitely complex and serendipitous and amazing that it seems miraculous, but it still can be explained scientifically.
All of it can be explained. Well,
I'm not true.
Oh, keep coming.
I mean, you're a doctor. You remember the citric acid cycle. I mean, that's too complicated for all of us here, but 20-some-odd steps just to put out a molecule of energy for our fires. I mean, it's so intricate. So, the hemoglobin molecule that can capture this oxygen and then release it in an area that doesn't have a lot of oxygen. It's so intricate. I think, though, that we see miracles every day, and we're still seeing them. And this thing up here is the biggest miracle in my mind. What you said about speech, I have a cousin who had a stroke, and he understands what you say, but he can't speak. That little part of his brain that allows him to formulate his thoughts into words, he can't do. That, that just shows us how many different, it's not just a whatever we do here to make words. And it's thought that maybe 40 or 50,000 years ago there was a genetic mutation that allowed this little thing, these vocal cords to form that otherwise would be like the apes and the Neanderthals and just grunting, not even forming words. So we're seeing miracles and what's happening with technology every day. They're miraculous, I should say.
Well, one comment about, you were talking about our blood vessels carrying oxygen and dropping it off where it's needed. In the hemoglobin, it's the iron atom that attaches to the oxygen. And I mentioned to you, like the other non-hydrogen atoms in our body, that was formed in a star that exploded. That iron atom made its way to you, an El Phoenix restaurant, and so you're breathing in oxygen from this stellar explosion. It's been estimated that thousands of stars, over 1,000, must have exploded to make the elements that we have within us, at least 1,000 stars. And so the oxygen that we are dependent on is a byproduct of an exploding star as is the iron that's carrying it to all our tissues to keep them going. I mean, I could keep going the book's worth about this, but I do hope more of you, I was pleased that so many found their life miraculous to start with, and I hope more of you do appreciate how amazing you are. And I said from the start that I would call myself spiritual but not religious, but there are things, let me just reach a statistic. Is there a creator? The religious ones will say yes. I say I don't know, but see, it's been pointed out that so many things are perfect for life. You can see I didn't look at any notes till this moment, but here's the Stephen Hawking quote. As you probably know, it's thought that the universe came into being with an explosion, a big bang, and the rate of expansion is critical, and it's set at the razor's edge. So gravity is a key factor in how fast the universe is expanding. If gravity is too strong, the universe contracts before life can form. If gravity is too weak, the ashes get scattered before life forms. So here's a quote from Stephen Hawking. If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang has been smaller by even one part in 100,000 million million, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size. It's that sensitive. And I have one other quote that I thought I would read, and this is from Brian Cox and Andrew Cohen in a book called Wonders of the Universe. And I'll shorten the quote. As a fraction of the lifespan of the universe is measured from its beginning to the evaporation of the last black hole, life as we know it is only possible for 1/1000th of a billion, billion, billionth, billion, billion, billionth of a percent. And that's why the most astonishing wonder of the universe is a moment in time, and that moment is now. So if you think that your life's going to be drastically better if you make $1,000 a year more, or whatever, your life is fabulous now. And I think we have too much, our culture, I think too much emphasizes what we don't have, and we don't recognize how magnificent what we do have is. I mean, that's sort of, so on the little blurb, Rob's, what changes? If you think that you're fabulous right now, I hope that you don't feel like you have to fight the universe quite to the extent that you might have thought if you didn't recognize how fabulous you are right now. It's not what you don't have that's critical. It's realizing all these miracles are yours for free. Other thoughts, questions? Yes.
It's a wonderful talk and a wonderful perspective.
Thank you.
And so I'm interested in your perspective on to have good, one must have bad, to understand good, one bad. Happiness. There was also a notion that given unlimited time, this was inevitable. That given enough time, this was inevitable. And I'm interested in your thoughts on the inevitableness of it versus the miraculousness of it.
I think it's miraculous whether, I don't know if it's inevitable or not. I think it's miraculous. I don't know if it's the result of a planner that set gravity just right and so on. I don't know the bigger issues. I see the miraculousness of it without, as I mentioned, a believer will say, it's God that made this miraculous thing, and an atheist or a scientist will say it's just the result of natural laws unfolding, and that's a bigger question than I feel knowledgeable to answer. It's an excellent question, I spend my days being grateful without an understanding of the bigger the bigger picture, and when I wrote the book, I was trying to be careful not to, because I don't know if there's a planner that set it up like this or not. A good question, and one of the many that I don't know the answers to. Treasurer, Mr. Treasurer.
So I saw an interesting piece of news this week that in 2013, in the world, we're going to spend over a trillion or multiple trillions of dollars on gadgets. So, that's kind of talks about at least one of the things that we do with this miraculous body and nature that you have. Somehow gadgets do something, or we do something with gadgets. But after I kind of had a near-death experience, I happened to be walking through a bookstore and ran across a title of a book called The Search of the Miraculous. And it's by a Russian engineer back in the 19th century, Ilya Vispensky. And so, I was expecting it to be more about miracles, I guess, than miraculous. But it turned out the book is about, he was searching for the miraculous, but what he found was that he found people, men, women, that had done something significant. And so I get to think, after reading this book and having experiences that I've had, that this, while we can be on this material treadmill, it's the relationships that we have in this system that we have to be able to relate to one another, to communicate, to have friends, to have family. And I think part of this, the education that would be great to come out of your idea is for people, our children, whatever, to realize that all these elements, atoms, whatever, all came from the same place and we're all part of the same universe.
We're all cousins. It's been estimated that any two people on Earth are no further apart than 50th cousins, and that's right regardless of race or ethnic group. There's always somebody, and even technology. I agree that it's the interpersonal relationships that are our riches, but I watched the football game, and man, the Cowboys lost again. So I was swept away by this superficial thread of what happened on a football field, and I'm not thinking, this is 2,000 miles away, people are playing football, and I'm sitting in my living room watching it live on this machine. So I was, like everybody else, blind to the underlying process as I was swept away by the superficial plot. But I would say, think of the computer as a toy, but think what you can do with it. it's miraculous too. I don't know anything about computers, but I do recognize that they too are miraculous if you think of it not just as it gave me this piece of information, but think of the process, yes.
Do you think that sometimes our inability to see past the superficial is like a defense mechanism to keep us from seeing past the superficial of the negative side of life?
My brother says, I have a minimally famous, slightly semi-celebrity brother, the actor Stephen Tobolowsky, if you've heard of him, is my brother. So he says that we're programmed to see the negatives because, if the caveman spends all his time worrying about saber-toothed tigers and he spends all day looking at no saber-toothed tiger, that's going to enhance his survival over his less psychotic friend who's thinking, is that not a handsome tiger in this way? So my brother's theory is our focus on the negative is a sort of survival mechanism that people survive to reproduce better if they're always looking for what's wrong. And we inherited their genes, so we're always looking for what's wrong and the threats this second. We spend our seconds thinking about the threats. And again, our mind to the rest, there's a story, one of the chapters in my book, there's an old East Asian story about a guy running from a tiger, since I'm thinking about tigers, and he's being pursued, and he sees a vine hanging over the edge of the cliff, and he thinks that's his only chance to be saved, and he lowers himself down the vine out of reach from the tiger, and he hears growling below him, and of course there's another tiger down below him, so now he's hanging on the vine between the two tigers, and then he feels his weight is starting to pull the roots out of this vine, so he knows this is curtains, and then he realizes this is a grapevine, and if they're in season, and he grabs one of those grapes, this is delicious. I mean, he knows there is no future, there is no past, there is only this grape, and it's delicious, and So I think we haunt ourselves with dragging past crises and with us and worrying about future crises. We squander many of our moments in that way. Yes.
So maybe it's only a society that enjoys a lot of luxury that is able to maybe look at your perspective and say, maybe it's time to see it from that point of view.
I don't know about that, because there are, I think our society, we try to achieve socioeconomic advancement. I think that's culturally programmed in, and there are other cultures, such as like the Tibet, or at least the olden days of Tibet, where people seek spiritual advancement rather than economic advancement. But I do think that we buy into, we think we're living life normally, like a normal person would live life, and we don't realize we're following a bunch of society's rules that mommy and daddy taught us when we were kids, and all our neighbors learned the same rules. So I think we don't question them because it's everybody in the culture reinforces them for us. So I'm trying to get people to think.
This gentleman here had a question right here. Back to your fire metaphor, I feel some pride that I've been able to assemble 75 kilograms into this thing that's got some autonomy. It's even more miraculous, as you say, that I keep doing it.
Do you know
how? And that this pattern persists as long as it has. And I'm wondering if you know, how often do I do it? What's the average life of a particular atom?
Well, the Adams long time to keep
the custody.
Well, the turnover is different based on the type of Adams. So they water I mentioned were 60% water. The turnover there is about 3% per day you exchange. Depends how many margaritas you have before the talk. But to sustain your 150-pound body, it's estimated you, over the course of a lifetime, will eat some 50 to 60 tons to sustain your body. So that's throwing a lot of logs on the fire to keep you going. See, you don't know anything about biochemistry, but your body does, and you have a sense of taste. And why does something taste good to you? Well, if there was a caveman that thought strychnine was really tasty, I am going to eat lots of that stuff. He died. He didn't reproduce. So the ones who reproduced were the ones who found tasty, the kind of molecules from which they could build the body. So your sense of taste, which is guiding what you ordered off the menu here, animals find tasty what allows them to survive. That's how a rabbit knows to eat carrots. The rabbits that ate carrots, that liked the taste of carrots, survived, reproduced like rabbits. Our body is quite wise that we keep building without studying nutrition books.
Okay, thank you. One last question, Ben. Last question.
I'm going to make a statement followed by a question. Tom Warren, Carlos Castaneda talked about making death your constant companion and therefore you live your life presently. As a physician who's been experienced death many times, I'm certain, with patients, but how has that impacted your philosophy on the book and then just your general being present in death, that relationship?
I gave a talk to another group about death, and it certainly puts in sharp focus our life. What if you did live forever, ever? What value would each day have if you're going to have an infinite number of them? But you don't. But you got this one. My 90-year-old father, who's got all kinds of health problems, says, it's all about today. Enjoy today. And I think if death has... I won't go into... There's biological reasons why death happens. That if you think about all the life forms, none of them live very long compared to the course of the universe. Evolutionary survival is favored by relatively short generation times that allow organisms to adapt. Ultimately, my answer to your question is, I hope it puts this moment in sharp focus where we're alive at El Phoenix and able to celebrate Elvis's birthday together.